morning. My name is Darla, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Massachusetts Energy Bill. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I would now like to turn the conference over to Veronica Edie. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Veronica Edie. I'm a vice president at the Conservation Law Foundation. I'm director of CLF's Massachusetts Advocacy Center. Thanks for joining us. I want to thank everybody from our Advocate Society, our board community, all of our friends and supporters. We've got several people on the phone, and we're also broadcasting live on Facebook. So for today's discussion, I've got Brad Campbell, who's the CLF president, along with Caitlin Peel Sloan, who's one of the staff attorneys in the Massachusetts office, who's been doing a lot of work at the State House around the energy bill. I'm going to have some questions for Brad and for Caitlin, and then I'll turn it over to you all for questions and answers, both on the phone and on Facebook. So I'll start by asking Brad, why is this energy bill so important, not just to Massachusetts, but in the context of New England?
Well, New England is really at a crossroads in terms of whether we will proceed and continue the great progress we've made in decarbonizing our energy system, or whether we will see a new generation of gas infrastructure, plants and pipes that will actually set us back in the effort to address climate change. We have very ambitious goals as a state. Our country, along with nearly 200 others, is committed to keeping climate change at a level that's not catastrophic, and only get there if we continue toward an energy platform that's dominated by renewables rather than by fossil fuels. I'd also add that for New England in particular, this is a matter of our economy as well. Some of the best innovators in the energy space, those developing the technologies, and the smart grids and the approaches that will allow us to decarbonize our electrical system. Those businesses are right here in New England, and so the economy is a big factor as well as our climate future.
So, Brad, you sort of touched on the Global Warming Solutions Act, and CLF's been really active around that. Do you think we have in the bill that's pending right now what we need to get us to our 2050 Global Warming Solutions Act reduction, which is 80% over the 1990 standards? Pretty aggressive.
No, I don't think this bill in itself or any single bill will get us there. But this bill does give us a number of important tools that'll give us progress toward those goals. And I'd highlight in particular the offshore wind procurement that's in the bill, really to generate a competitive market. We already have multiple wind power developers, experienced wind power developers that are ready to proceed on sites that are well accepted by local communities. They need to see a signal that they should invest in this region. We have in the bill an increase in the rate of increase of the renewable portfolio standard. The RPS is essentially the rule that utilities need to buy an increasing amount of their electricity from carbon-free sources, and doubling that rate of increase over time means there'll be an automatic pressure to stimulate development and use of renewable energy. There's also, in some versions of the bill, a cap or a prohibition that we think is very important that keeps the electricity industry from the electric utilities from getting into the business of subsidizing gas pipelines. We have a proliferation of proposals for new gas infrastructure from Rhode Island to Maine, and that includes both plants and pipes. And if those move forward, we think that we will be locking into a fossil fuel platform for another generation when we need to be moving in the opposite direction. And certainly, government shouldn't be in the business at this point of propping up fossil fuel plants and pipelines.
So, Brad, that's an important point, and there's also been a lot of discussion around hydropower. What's the role of hydropower for Massachusetts' clean energy future?
Well, I support the use of hydropower as one element of getting us to a decarbonized electrical system and a decarbonized economy. But it can't be the entire solution or even the dominant solution. And so our concern has been not to oppose hydropower, but to recognize that it should play a limited role because we don't want it to displace or crowd out the development of renewable energy sources right here at home in our New England states, where there's wind potential, plenty of solar potential, and plenty of room for innovation by homegrown companies.
Okay, great. I'm going to ask you a question now, Caitlin. The bill is in conference committee. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. So the energy bill, both the House and Senate have been working on an energy bill for this whole session, which is 2 years long. And the House passed its version in early June, and the Senate passed its at the end of June. And then to reach a final bill, they need to bring them together and work out the differences. They need to compromise. So the conference committee has three members of each branch, and they are negotiating the terms of the final bill.
Are there provisions in one bill or the other that are especially threatening or especially appealing for CLF?
You know, it's gratifyingly, I think there's nothing that's an existential threat in either bill. There were rumors all along the way before the bills were passed that there might be some pro-gas language, which CLF and our many partners and allies work to fight to keep out. But there are certainly some areas that, especially with some technical language, that would make a huge difference if we went with the Senate version as opposed to the House version. And importantly, the Senate bill does a better job of making sure that onshore wind, as Brad mentioned, is given a prominent role in any hydropower procurement solicitation, because the whole game with hydropower is getting transmission lines built to get it down from Canada, and that's the exact same issue that onshore wind farms face. So we're really hoping to see a strong role for onshore wind.
And so, Caitlin, what does this mean for our utility bills? Is this protecting consumers? Are our electricity bills that are high right now going to get any lower?
You know, I think the biggest promise of buying clean energy for our electricity bills is that if you really look at your bill over the last 5 or 6 years, prices have gone up and down very dramatically with swings in the fossil fuel industry and with natural gas prices or oil prices being high versus low. And if we buy cheap and reliable resources like onshore wind for a long-term contract, that's a real hedge against those volatile swings in fossil fuel prices.
And there are two myths that I think we've been fighting against. One is the myth that the hydropower coming from Canada will be incredibly inexpensive, when in fact none of the utilities that are proposing to buy hydropower have locked in a price at all, let alone the low prices that are sometimes claimed to be associated with hydropower. You know, the second myth is that bringing in more natural gas through pipelines and new plants will bring down energy prices. And essentially, despite even with the advent of shale gas, there has been and continues to be volatility in the gas markets that has been with us for a generation. And there's no reason to think that volatility and the price spikes for families and businesses that volatility brings is going to go away. And so we think the right course is further investment in homegrown renewables and zero carbon sources, and the changes in our energy platform, like a smarter grid, that make more efficient use of the fossil fuel infrastructure we already have.
Thanks, Brad. And I think it's important to underscore the point you made where the idea of new gas pipelines bringing down energy prices really is a myth, because all of the studies that have been funded by industry to try to make that point, they all pretend that we're still in 2013. They ignore all of the changes that have gone on since then, and they ignore the prospect of a bill like this buying clean energy for the short and long term. So they're just not credible.
They also ignore, conveniently, the study by our Massachusetts Attorney General, or commissioned by our Massachusetts Attorney General, Maura Healey, that showed that we don't need new gas capacity to keep the lights on or even to avoid price spikes. So that is an important point to keep in mind.
Well, it's been a long journey with energy legislation. We've been working on it for years here at CLF, and it looks like we are inching towards a conclusion, at least for now. So the legislative session ends on July 31st. Kaylin, what are the next steps?
It's a little bit funny at the end of this legislative session because of the National Party Convention being earlier than normal. So our House and Senate are only able to meet in formal sessions this coming Saturday and then next Saturday and Sunday. So they're choreographing an intricate dance to get all of the bills that they want to get through done in those specific timeframes. So everyone is waiting with bated breath on the conference committee to report out the final bill, and then the House and Senate will be considering it and I think passing it either this Saturday or next Saturday or Sunday.
Really exciting. Brad, what can some of the people on the line and on Facebook, the average citizen, CLF supporter, what can we do?
I can't underestimate the importance of making sure your legislators hear from you, that you support the development of renewables, a substantial offshore wind industry, the increase in the renewable portfolio standard, a prohibition on the gas subsidies. And I can't underestimate that we're at a point where a good outcome is not assured. In December, we thought we had a fix to the solar cap that has really constrained our solar industry here in Massachusetts. But what emerged at the 11th hour was an increase in that cap that simply allowed projects that were already in the queue to move forward. And I think the difference is that they didn't hear from enough people in their communities that this was important and that they were paying attention. So contacting your legislator, contacting the governor's office, these are important elements. And, of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't shamelessly say supporting CLF so that we can sustain our advocacy efforts so that we get a good outcome is one of the important things you can do as well.
Thank you both. And now I think we'll start taking questions. I know people on the line and on Facebook probably have a lot of questions for you, and this is a unique opportunity to have both of you here to engage. Darla, can you explain to our listeners on the line how to submit questions?
If you would like to ask an audio question, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, that's star 1.
Thanks, Darla. So our first question, Pamela, do you want to ask your question for Brad and Caitlin?
Yes, a couple things. Number 1, CLF did a suit on gas leaks, and so I'm wondering in what ways, and was very successful with the Massachusetts Supreme Court, and I'm wondering in what ways the Omnibus Energy Bill is going to address that. And then I have a second part, and that is on financing energy efficiency. Have we got anything besides the renewable portfolio standards in there that we could advocate for that would get us a more massive amount of green financing like green banks? So two parts.
Thank you, Pamela. Let me address those in turn. CLF did win a case before our highest court, the Supreme Judicial Court, demanding and ordering that the DEP implement volumetric declining reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And one of the issues that we are now advocating before the agency, before DEP, is that a very low-cost way and very effective way to reach our greenhouse goals would be to address those gas leaks and mandate further reductions in the leaks. So that's a very important element of this. A second piece is we have supported provisions in this bill that would also mandate further leaks and could be implemented more quickly than the regulatory process would do. We are continuing to support those, and that is one of the issues that when you contact your legislature, telling them that gas leaks are important to you is a very important thing, because one of the terrible things that is happening is the prior legislation requiring the utilities to address gas leaks, and these leaks are of methane, which is one of the most potent greenhouse gases, where the leak was in a confined space and creating a safety hazard. The way the utilities have addressed them in some instances has simply been to vent the leak rather than fix the leak. And that's a practice we have to stop so that we actually get greenhouse gas reductions, and just as important, so that our communities are protected.
Yeah, that's right. And thanks, Pamela. The energy efficiency financing question is a good one. There is one provision in the Senate bill that may or may not survive that would call for a task force to study the future of financing energy efficiency. But overall, I think green banks and other alternate financing mechanisms for efficiency and renewables and other absolutely necessary technologies and steps that we need to take, that's going to be a next session issue for the legislature.
So coming up in January.
Yep.
Okay. We have a couple of questions on Facebook. I'm going to go to Fred first, who says, and I'll just read it. Fred says, I've been reading a little about Governor Cuomo's reforming the Energy Vision program in New York. It seems to be more comprehensive and far-sighted approach than what we're doing in Massachusetts. They're rethinking the business model for utilities so that utilities will have an incentive to support distributed energy resources. Have you looked at this? And should we start thinking about and doing something similar in the New England states?
We have looked at the so-called REV program in New York. We think it's a great step forward in terms of how we transition our energy system. Unfortunately, some of the major utilities in this region, in all the New England states, are tend to look backward instead of forward in terms of how the utilities play in a world where there are more renewables and more alternatives to just building more plants and pipes. And we are involved in the grid modernization docket at the DPU, where these issues are going to come to the fore in a regulatory sense. But that's an area where the administration has not, unfortunately, shown much vision. We are working on that front to try to bring them the vision that isn't there yet. We're also working with the grid operator, which is the New England Independent System Operator, kind of an obscure agency, but one that's enormously important, to try to introduce carbon pricing or carbon requirements into the wholesale electric markets. And that, too, we think would drive more renewables development, would drive renewables financing, and it would help our transition. It would certainly be as powerful as many other measures.
That's right. I think the Massachusetts grid modernization effort really is troublingly narrow. I'll just punctuate that remark by saying they're not looking at utility business reform, and that's really a key that New York has seized on. So that we'll definitely be working on that, and you'll hear more from us on that going forward.
So Fred has one more question, and then we'll go back to the line. Fred, your second question is, If the pipeline tax is ruled out by the omnibus bill, what alternatives would Spectra have for financing? And Spectra is building a pipeline company, a pipeline building company. And is it likely that Spectra would pull out as Kinder Morgan did?
They just told Commonwealth Mag recently that that the banning the pipeline tax, if CLF wins its appeal of the pipeline tax, or if the DPU doesn't allow the specific contracts, that would not kill the project. But they declined to let us know what their alternate means of financing are, and there's no historical precedent for, you know, a company taking on a cost of that size by themselves. I don't know that shareholders would allow that.
And unfortunately, we had some bad news earlier this week, when in another context, the main PUC, against the staff recommendation, essentially adopted Governor LePage's gas tax proposal and decided to proceed with a contract with Spectra. So Spectra has been significantly encouraged at this point by the action in Maine. We're hoping to stop it by the ban in Massachusetts.
That's really important, and that really brings together the whole New England context, how we all impact each other, all the New England states.
Yeah, New England is 50% of the regional load. So Massachusetts is 50% of New England's load. And our leadership here is really going to be the driver of an energy transformation, if we get it right.
On the line, we have a question from Ellen. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning. Thank you, Brad and Caitlin. I'm a customer of a National Grid electricity customer, and often they try to convert you to save energy by using some of their greener options, where some of your electricity could actually be purchased through renewable options. And I'm just wondering, is that something that really does help the environment? Is that something, you know, there is an additional cost to do so, but does that really make a difference?
Thanks, Ellen. It does if that greener option is buying Class 1 Massachusetts renewable energy credits. That's a little jargony, but it's really important because in other places, they have lower standards for what they call renewable energy, and so a utility could say, hey, you can buy green energy from us for a surcharge, but they're just taking stuff that we may not like from out of region. And so what you really want to be doing if you're spending a little extra on your bill is supporting Massachusetts and New England-based renewable energy.
Thanks, Caitlin. Thanks, Brad. We have a question from David on the line. David, what's your question? Good morning.
Yeah, I wanted to ask whether you all have any sense of what the conference committee report is likely to look like, especially when it comes to the size of the offshore wind allotment.
The only indications are that it would be somewhere between the Senate 2,000 megawatts and the House is 1,200 megawatts. The idea that it will be a compromise is really the only thing they've revealed. The conference committee is keeping any results pretty close to the vest because they know some will be controversial and they don't want to have a lot of discussion about something that's a very carefully crafted final.
We've pushed for at least a 2,000 megawatt procurement for the simple reason that you really need critical mass in terms of the purchase in order to create the competition that's going to make that energy cheaper. If it's almost a prescription for failure if you do a very small procurement, limited entry by companies, and very few economies of scale, that's going to be more expensive. So to have a competitive wind industry that's going to reach parity with the fossil fuels, we need that procurement to be as large as possible. And so in your calls to legislators and the governor's office, you want the wind procurement at 2,000 is a very, very positive message.
That's right. And that 2000 number is also very relevant for the ability to build an industry here, as Brad said before. That's a very significant sort of break-even number that's been cited in studies and by offshore wind developers to say if we have a procurement of that size, that means we can build the supply chain here rather than shipping it over from Europe.
Great. I want to jump back to Facebook. We have a question from Andy. Does CLF have any insight into which provisions not in both bills, like doubling the RPS increment or prohibiting the pipeline tax, are likely to be adopted?
They're in the black box right now. I will say that Senator Downing, has been acknowledged by everyone in the Senate as the real leader on energy issues, and doubling the RPS is one of his bills, one of his provisions. So I have hopes that he'll be able to keep that one alive. The pipeline tax is obviously very political, and we strongly believe that the Senate's unanimous adoption of that measure and almost 100 House members signing a letter saying that they didn't want the pipeline tax earlier this year will help get that across the finish line, but the utilities are very powerful, so we'll have to see.
Great. So we have another question on the telephone line. Josh, what's your question?
Sure. First of all, thank you for all your work in the legislature and in the courts to stop the pipeline tax. But I'm wondering if the pipeline tax does go forward, what can CLF and its supporters do to make sure that the individual pipeline contracts trying to take advantage of it can be stopped?
Well, we're going to be in all of those dockets opposing those contracts. We right now have a case that is ripe for decision. It's already been argued before the Supreme Judicial Court, asking them to enforce what the law says, which is gas companies are the ones that should be buying gas capacity, not electric companies, putting ratepayers at risk. And so, you know, supporting our work, because participating in, you know, if we get the legislative fix or we win the Supreme Court case, you know, that'll be a clean win. If not, we will be in trench warfare on a number of different fronts, and obviously the more fronts we have to engage in and appear in and file briefs in, the more expensive a proposition it is for us as a matter of advocacy.
That's right, and we're in those trenches right now in the first two potential contracts under the pipeline tax scheme. So that's what my summer has been about and will be about until about the end of September. And it's a real mud fight. We need legislators to understand that a lot of money is being spent on this really illegal proposition, and the legislature could very easily clarify what the law means.
And on the positive side, we were able, through that trench warfare in the case of Kinder Morgan, to create enough uncertainty for them as a company, as investors, to say, this is not worth the candle anymore. It's not a good risk for us. And so we were able to declare victory, as you know, in that case, as referred to by an earlier caller. But we have many, many other challenges in front of us.
Brad, I just want to ask you a couple of clarifying questions. You mentioned DPU, you mentioned docket. Can you tell us what that is, and is it going on as the legislature is doing something? What is that process?
Well, the Department of Public Utilities is essentially the utility or electric and gas regulator for the Commonwealth, and what the utilities don't get before the legislature, they tend to try to get from the regulators, from the bureaucracy. And so, for example, in the case of the gas tax, they have tried to get that from the Department of Public Utilities, or DPU, that when they try to get those, that get, when gas tax, it creates a docket or essentially a case, and it is that docket that we took to the Supreme Judicial Court or challenged to say they don't have the authority to do this gas tax as just an agency. That is something that the legislature would have to authorize. That's the process we get into. It's not directly to court, but it's in an administrative agency docket that we then have to challenge in the courts.
Okay. Did you want to add anything, Caitlin?
I think that sums it up.
Okay. Well, I'm going to jump back to Facebook. Fred has another question for you. Thanks, Fred. Is there any likelihood that the bill that emerges from committee will include provisions that would make Governor Baker refuse to sign it? Great question.
I'll take a first stab at it, and I'm sure Caitlin has her view. I think if they eliminated the hydro procurement, the governor would likely veto it because that's really the centerpiece of his program in the short term. I think there's some risk that a gas tax prohibition, since the DPU that is proposing it as part of his administration, I think that prohibition might lead him to veto it, so we're watching that very carefully. And if we are looking at a potential veto threat, we may be coming back to you with action alerts saying, call the governor's office and tell him to sign the bill. But Caitlin, do you have thoughts on other things that might be poison pills for the governor?
Yeah, you know, the governor, as I mentioned, there are sort of six big, like, major mega pieces of legislation and various topics, economic development, energy, rideshare reform, and the governor hasn't really tipped his hand about the exact contents of those bills and what he's looking for other than that he wants to see them come through. And so I'm confident that at this point we've spent all the stakeholders and all the legislators have spent enough time with the governor working on these issues that there's definitely going to be hydro in this bill. I'm not sure what it would take for the governor to veto, but I am pretty confident that we can get this bill done.
Yeah, you know, and this is, even though it's a black box and it's just technically the legislators who have a say in what the product is, the governor's appointees are certainly in the room as this is being negotiated, and I think there's a genuine good faith desire from both the legislatures and the governor's office to get this done in a way that the governor doesn't have to either veto or threaten to veto.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. On the line, we now have Teresa with a question. Teresa, are you with us? Okay.
Tracy, your line is open.
I think she dropped off. She's on. Okay.
Teresa, can you say your question?
Teresa, if you've muted your phone, please unmute before asking your question.
Well, I think we may be having a technical glitch with Teresa, so can we move to another question?
We'll move on to the next question, and maybe Teresa will be able to come back to us. Our next question is from Mary. Mary, what's your question this morning?
Well, it's really more of a comment. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can. If you speak up a little, it would help.
Okay. There's been some talk online that the energy bill is what we're going to get it's going to be sort of important for our future, our short-term future. And I guess my concern is, what do we do if it doesn't come out the way we want it?
For our part at CLF, if there are disappointments in the bill, the case we won before the Supreme Judicial Court essentially gives us a second bite of the apple to try to get some of the carbon reductions we would see from the bill in another form. Obviously, we want to get as much as we can from the bill. I think we're reasonably confident that we will get that, although the size of the procurement, the gas tax prohibition, those are key elements that are in the balance at this point and uncertain, and the reason that the legislators and the governor's office hearing from you strongly is so important.
And I would just say that the chance of something nefarious that was not previously discussed being added into the bill is almost zero. So it's really a matter of, will this bill go far enough with the provisions that we've been talking about?
We have Doug on the line. Good morning, Doug. What's your question?
Doug, your line is open.
Okay. All right, well, Darla, I'm going to go to Pamela then, and maybe Doug will be able to fix whatever technical difficulty there is.
Yeah, so I'm back on with another question. That is, part of the bill has been on energy storage, and it isn't real clear to me what energy storage actually is, and what does that mean? Does that mean natural gas storage or hydro storage? And just another quick comment, and that is the greenhouse gases. Well, my understanding from CLF's work, actually, is that the biggest source of greenhouse gas is right now gas leaks. And we have an opportunity as citizens to run gas leaks campaigns in our towns. And that would bring a much stronger awareness, sort of town by town, of the role of natural gas, which isn't really natural, it's fracked gas. And, you know, we could get a lot more dialogue on gas if we ran a local campaign because of leaks. And Mothers Out Front has got a really good speakers bureau on gas leaks.
Yeah, you
so
took
going back to storage, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We are working very closely with Mothers Out Front on that issue, and are very you know, they're wonderful partners, and they are going town by town, and I would, you know, I would encourage everyone on the phone to even if you're not a mother, to find out about their local efforts because they're enormously important. I do want to address energy storage because it is one of the more exciting things that can happen as we move to a greener grid, and that is electricity storage really helps the grid in a couple of ways. One is some renewables like wind are intermittent, meaning the wind doesn't blow all the time. Obviously, the sun doesn't shine at night. And even solar power doesn't perfectly align with peak energy demand. But using storage, you can shift the production of wind and solar so that you overcome at least some of that intermittency. You can combine it with, you can put storage in critical points in the grid so that you don't have to build new plants to manage the peak. You can actually get by with fewer plants or with the plants that we have running less intensely. So energy storage is really part of the solution set for a smarter grid and a cleaner energy future.
Is that batteries? Is that batteries or,
yeah,
you know? Or,
it's energy storage, I guess, generally, there are ways to store natural gas. That's part of the natural gas system, but that's really not what we're talking about. Actually, one of the first means of electricity storage, as you said, was hydropower, where you pump water basically up a hill and then release it down when you need it. That's also not what the bill is talking about. The bill very specifically defines essentially battery storage and similar technologies. That it's the governor is, his agencies are looking into energy storage. They're trying to make some progress on it, but we and many legislators think they're not moving aggressively enough. So the bill would mandate that our utilities procure energy storage supplies.
And utilities that have done this, and in particular there are a number of California utilities that have done it, have reaped significant system benefits because it helps stabilize the voltage. It does something, it regulates frequency, just to be completely arcane about it. And as I said, it helps offset intermittency. So it benefits the system in a number of ways. and really helps facilitate the integration of renewables into the grid.
So is it combined with, I mean, is there some scheme to combine it with transportation, like more electric cars that do the storage, like overnight in batteries and partially use their storage capacity for maintaining the grid, that kind of thing?
There are proposals in which electric vehicles would play a role in storage, in the sense that, you know, while the car is parked, you would essentially be able to provide some of the storage services that storage provides. You know, the one headwind to that is that, you know, we tend not to use, cars tend to be idle the most at night, and at night is also when electricity demand is lowest. So the more likely focus of that will be on cars that are, you know, essentially sit in a parking lot all day and might be able to help manage the peak.
And I think when we talk about really interesting cutting-edge strategies like using electric vehicles for energy storage, there's potential for that on, you know, an individual home level and on a system-wide level, and that's all tied into the grid modernization efforts, as we were talking about before. And so definitely keep listening and support CLF's work on that, because we are one of the leaders on the cutting edge in Massachusetts.
Wonderful. Teresa is back with us. Teresa, do you want to ask her?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yep.
Hi. Going back to the question regarding the pipeline gas leaks, I think you mentioned they fix them by venting them. Can you tell me exactly what that means?
And this, we don't have good data on how often this happens, but in some cases, essentially venting means digging or drilling a hole so that the gas escapes into the atmosphere rather than actually digging up the pipe and fixing it.
So in essence, is it leaking more gas that way?
Yes.
Thank you. They identify the leak because it could explode because it's bottling up in an enclosed space. And then, so their solution is to just send it into the atmosphere instead.
Okay, thank you.
And that's obviously bad for the climate, since methane is such a powerful greenhouse gas. But it's also bad for families and businesses because they are still charging you for that lost gas. They're allowed to charge you, and it just is a system that doesn't make sense.
Thank you.
So we have two last questions. Doug is back on the line. Good morning, Doug.
Hi, how are you? Can you hear me?
Oh, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, good. On the case that you won at the Supreme Judicial Court, Kane versus DEP, it requires that the generation be conducted within the Commonwealth. What is going to be the enforcement on that decision, and how does that manipulate itself? And then, secondarily, how does solar fit into that equation?
Well, the court's decision very much required the agency to insist on and require by regulation that the greenhouse gas reductions occur in the Commonwealth. We do have some regional mechanisms, like the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, where there's a cap regionally, and the reductions that come from that cap and from that system will still count toward the Massachusetts limit. But we are considering a number of elements, or have proposed to the agency a number of ways to do that. One would be a simple ramp down in their permit, so that if it appears they're not reducing their greenhouse gases enough, their permits will actually ratchet down in terms of the number of tons of CO2 the power plants can emit. We actually, CLF, was able to negotiate exactly that kind of ratchet down in a plant in Salem, Massachusetts, where a coal plant that we were very much trying to close was replaced with a natural gas plant, rather, you know, as a matter of compromise, we negotiated with the plant sponsor that they would ramp down their CO2 emissions over time, essentially to zero, so that by 2050, which is the next major milestone in the state greenhouse gas reductions, that plant would be shut down. The investors will be able to make a reasonable profit. The immediate electricity needs will be addressed, but they'll be on a schedule so that they will get to zero carbon emissions just when we need them to.
And I do think it's important to note that there has been some misinformation about what that decision actually says about electric, where electric emissions reductions have to occur. The GWSA itself does say if you're using a unit of energy, a kilowatt hour, in Massachusetts, reduction, you know, you can track that back to where it was generated in terms of measuring reduction. So if we are importing coal power from New York State for some reason, that counts, that gets caught by the system, and you have to reduce those emissions as well, not just ones generated in Massachusetts.
Yeah, the idea is that what we don't want to happen is what's called leakage, where, sure, all the utilities in Massachusetts ramp down their emissions, but it just means we're importing more power from elsewhere. That's not a solution, obviously.
Great. And last question, Mary, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm on the line. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So I hope that you'll put your answer to Doug online, because I was so worried about my question that I kind of couldn't listen to your answer real well. But I was, you know, in the energy bill, I was trying to figure out, and ISO New England says that, you know, the sun doesn't shine so, isn't so high in the sky in this winter, and wind, there's seasonal changes for wind. And so I was trying to figure out, well, where is the power going to come from when those problems occur? And I thought, well, hydro is all I could think of. I don't know if we can negotiate contracts that will let us have hydro just at certain times of year. And also, I couldn't figure out how big a source of energy gas from being leaked is, how much energy could be gotten from the gas that being burned instead of leaked. But I kind of had the impression that ISO New England they're kind of conservative. I mean, maybe they should be, I don't know, but I'm not sure they're totally on our side. Is there any way to try to get them to be more forward-thinking, and are there other engineers that that we can call on to help us figure these things out?
I think historically you are absolutely right that ISO New England has been very conservative, and I think that's part of the culture of the utility electricity industry. They like things that they can switch on and off, and things that aren't available to switch on and off at some times they consider not to be dispatchable. But there's really been a change in thinking nationally and even at ISO New England that, for example, through the use of storage, matching small fast ramping gas with wind, or matching hydro with wind, that renewables, even if they are intermittent in some way, can be made available 24/7 if they are done right. And so in most markets now, wind is considered a dispatchable resource. And the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, in our discussions and ISO New England's discussions with other constituencies, they're now considering introducing carbon as a factor into their market mechanism, is a very encouraging sign, and it's a very recent development, and one that we're hoping they'll be prepared to pursue and implement quickly.
Yeah, and I think just to emphasize that. One of the most frustrating things about that sort of older, more conservative mindset on energy is that they try to look to a single solution. Coal used to be our dominant form of energy. Gas is now our dominant form of energy. But what we're looking for is a very diverse energy system that will fill in the blanks when the sun's not shining, when the wind's not blowing. All of the different pieces will work together. You know, coincidentally, a lot of the time, if the wind's not blowing, it's a pretty sunny, hot day. Or if the sun's not shining, it's a little stormy, we're getting a lot of wind. You know, there are many other technologies that can play into that, but it's important to look past the idea that, you know, it would be impossible to build enough solar to provide all of our energy. You know, it's about the mix of solutions.
You know, fuel diversity is absolutely, or power diversity is absolutely essential. And, you know, this is one of those cases where, you know, those who don't learn history are bound to repeat it. We have made the mistake as a region, as a country, repeatedly of over-reliance on natural gas and then suffered the price spikes and dysfunction that occur when the gas price swings up. Even if shale gas is very plentiful, the more plentiful it is, the more of it that will be taken for export to overseas markets, in which case the price will go up. So we need to have a different energy platform, and replacing coal with gas is only going to bring a bad result for climate and an unhappy result in the electric bills of families and businesses. I'm gonna punt on the other part of your question. I don't think we know off the top in the actual energy value of the gas that's being lost. But rather than quantify it, our push has been to make the gas distribution companies fix it, so that if they're not fixing it, they shouldn't be able to pay consumers for it. I'm sorry, they shouldn't be able to charge consumers for it the way they currently can, because that'll create the right incentives for them to ensure that the system is sound and that the leaks are fixed.
Brad, Caitlin, I am sorry to say we're going to have to bring our hour to a close. Thank you so much. This has been really enlightening, and I'm sure that the people on the line and on Facebook really got a wonderful explanation of what's happening right now in our energy world, the realm of energy at CLF. Thank you all for calling. Thank you, everybody on Facebook. For those of you on the line, all of the attendees will receive a recording that will be emailed to you, and we'd be happy if you shared that with your networks. You should feel free to. The audio of this, or the visual, will also be posted on Facebook. So if you want to go to Facebook and see us all sitting there chatting, that's going to be accessible as well. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.